This chart behaves for various lengths of cable. The chart gives you a beautiful graphic display of what's happening. And as long as you know how to properly reading it, it's telling you a very nice truth. But quite a degree of accuracy, 2 or 3%, 2 or 3 decimal places of accuracy. For a person who likes doing it mathematically, I believe it's cotangent. I think if you take the characteristic impedance of the cable, multiply it by the cotangent of the length of the cable, and that gives you the reactance, if I got it correct, I think it does. That gives you the reactance in ohms, and then by the formula for capacitive reactance, you can convert that back into picofarads if you want to. However, once you know that you're resonating an inductor and the inductive reactance at your frequency is 75 ohms of inductive reactance, you know that you want to create a 75 ohm capacitive reactance. If you're using 75 ohm cable with that formula, cotangent, it'll turn out to be exactly 45 degrees. 45 degrees is an eighth wavelength. So, in my crazy example, an eighth wavelength of cable, of 75 ohm cable, will give you 75 ohms of capacitive reactance as an open circuit stub. I know that the average person is going to have to hear the details of that multiple times for it to make sense. But if you're a little bit frustrated right now, you're in good company. A certain number of people are, and I understand that. Okay, I think we should hurry up before we use up all of our time and press go right ahead with your question, which we now know is on a different question. Whiskey 2, Papa Whiskey, K2RIW, and how are they treating you in Patchogue, Preston?
Life is good, sitting on the deck overlooking the Great South Bay. You can see Fire Island very clearly, and it's a gorgeous night. Okay, we're going to go down below UHF, down below VHF, down below HF, all the way down to 60 cycles for this question. I had an interesting experience recently, which I've had the same experience before in my life, and I decided to really wonder about what is the actual cause on it. The players in this drama are going to include a regular circuit breaker box, an outlet, and an undefined set of outlets going on inside the house, daisy chained off of that outlet. Are we good so far?
We sure are. And at certain frequencies with your antenna in the house, you get certain kinds of resonance in your wiring. I'm going to make some guesses. Go right ahead, press.
Okay, the odd experience was I was in the garage standing on the cement or concrete floor. I touched a device that's plugged in. I touched its chassis and I felt a tingle. Not a full shock, but a noticeable tingle. So I measured that chassis and I found it to be 55 volts above neutral. Ground was 55 volts above neutral. So I did a little sleuthing and I found out the device that the outlet that was plugged into turned out to have had an open ground. Now that outlet is right next to this electrical box. It was extraordinarily easy to repair this, tying the missing ground to the bus bar inside the breaker box, everything calmed down. My question is theory. I asked a couple of smart people about this, and they substantially agreed, but I'm still short of understanding it. Changing battery here. My question is, the missing ground, the wire is not connected properly. Was that perhaps inducing the voltage into it?
Okay, I've got a guess. I ran into a rather similar situation way back in 1956, back in the days when all of the plugs in the wall used to have two prongs. The third prong, the grounding for pieces of electronics, essentially didn't exist way back in 1956. And I'm using my Heathkit AR3 receiver. And my Heathkit AR3 receiver, I'm using it on the 40-meter CW novice portion of the band. And I remember coming down to my basement early one morning with my bare feet in my pajamas and starting to operate the rig. And as I touched the chassis of the Heathkit AR3 receiver, and I'm standing on the concrete floor, I felt that tingle. and like you, I put a AC voltmeter on there, and I measured something like 58 volts. What was happening in my case is that when you study the schematic diagram of the Heathkit AR3 receiver, let me drop. In order to make sure that the input zip cord, the 110-volt zip cord coming into the receiver, wasn't becoming part of the antenna, they had a 0.01 disc ceramic or 0.02 disc ceramic capacitor from each side of the 110-volt zip cord line to chassis. Therefore, the chassis was on a capacitor divider network between the two sides of the 110-volt line, 120-volt line. And because the 120-volt line, one side is called return, it's essentially grounded somewhere in the universe, either at your fuse panel or back at LIPA, LUCO in those days or whatever, and the other side is hot with 120 volts above ground, and you've got this capacitor divider network of a pair of 0.02 microfarad disc ceramic green capacitors. That capacitor divider network has a significant amount of 60 cycle current flowing through it. That's then a tap connected to the chassis. Therefore, the chassis is always 58 volts above ground. So your particular appliance could have been falling into that category. If that appliance of yours had a third prong, which is the so-called green wire, the neutral, and if that in turn was properly connected at the socket where you plugged it in, and that was connected back to the neutral and grounding of the fuse panel, the problem would have gone away. So what you're describing sounds like the capacitor voltage divider network situation. That's a guess on my part. I'm back to you, Press. Whiskey.
2, Major, transmit.
Whiskey 2, Papa Whiskey, K2LIW on the TechNet.
All right, the part of the puzzle that I didn't have a chance to say because my battery failed, I'm now out to mobile, is that the outlet I was plugged into had a missing ground. Somebody had wired it with only hot and neutral. However, there were other outlets daisy chained off of that in the rest of the house that had a ground wire that was connected to nothing, but it was connected. In other words, when I repaired everything, I replaced the missing ground from the first outlet to the bus box, everything calmed down. But my question is, people have postulated that there is perhaps an appliance or a light or something was wired backwards somewhere in the house, so that black to white. But my theory is that that ground wire, which was essentially connected to nothing, being in parallel with the black and the white wires inside the wall, I'm figuring that that 55 volts was being induced. But other people have said, no, induction doesn't happen at this frequency and this power level. Do you have any theories on what I might find when I start looking in the house? Like, some people have said I'm going to find that there's an outlet wired backwards and that would cause it. I'm just not sure I get the theory.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, but first let me ask Press. Press, what was the appliance? Did it have a metal case? What was the actual appliance that you were touching where you got the tingle? Back to you, Chris.
Happened to be an MSF 5000 repeater. Yes, it has a metal case, and that metal case was sitting at 55 volts above ground because it was its ground pin was connected to the ground pin in the outlet that had no ground connection to it.
WB2HWW, I know the answer.
Stand by there, Howie. Press, when you study the schematic diagram of that device that you're describing, was there a set of capacitors, was there a so-called dirty box? In other words, was there kind of an input connector with the ordinary three prongs to it that's recessed in the package, which has an RF filter network built inside? If so, it is the capacitor divider network we're talking about. Was there a filter network on where the 110-volt line went into that appliance? Over to you, Press.
I would say there's an extraordinarily good chance that you're right. It's a repeater. It probably has some filtering on the AC input.
HWW with a question for him, Dick.
Yeah, we'll get you in a second, Howie. That filtering has filtering from each side of the line to ground. That is the bypass capacitor. Now we're going to take the people in the order in which they signed in. Glenn first, KC2QIQ, K2RIW. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, exactly along the lines that you're saying, Dick, but I just want to elaborate on it a little bit more. All devices that are usually connected to wall outlets, especially with metal chassis, have something called leakage. It doesn't have to be a physical capacitor. You have devices in your kitchen like a refrigerator. It's got a motor in it, a compressor, and it's got windings inside of it, and they're mounted around, you know, metal shafts, and that whole motor is, you know, somehow strapped down to the chassis of the device. And there's going to be some leakage, 60-cycle leakage into the chassis, just mechanically leaking from the motor in. There's all kinds of components inside your house, stoves, many, many items. And there's always going to be some small leakage from those lines into the chassis. That's why it's always very, very important to make sure that the chassis is tied back down to the utility ground, because those leakage currents basically will float up to, approximately half of the line voltage. So if you're on a 120 outlet, it's not all that unusual to see, especially if you have a floating ground chassis, for that thing to float up to near somewhere darn close to 60 volts of AC power. So it can be a capacitor and an EMI filter. It could be a power motor with some leakage in it. It could be many, many different devices. Sometimes just even a transformer mounted down onto a metal plate by itself can have some leakage into the into a metal plate. So there are many, many things that can cause leakage from an electrical circuit into a metal chassis. Very, very important to make sure that ground is attached. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment?
Yeah, somebody said comment. We'll get to you after Howie. And that is, as I see it, Press, it doesn't require any miswiring of the rest of your house. Just that one appliance with its EMI filter, with a non-contact to the third prong, the round prong, the green wire, the safety wire, no contact to that, and the ordinary EMI filter will give you the condition you got. I don't think you necessarily have any other wiring errors in the rest of your house. Howie, go right ahead with your question or comment, K2RIW in the second hand.
For the station, that's an MSF5, it's not an appliance, it's a repeater. Are you using an open frame power supply? If you look in the repeater, what do you have, a ferret resonant supply? If it has the open frame power supply, which is a Motorola supply with the big transformer, yes. There are two little capacitors on the input. They're like 001s across the line, and yes, you can get zapped. I've been zapped many a times at repeater sites years ago. You know, when you touch like an MSF5000 or a Micor base, does that have an open frame power supply, like a ferret resonant supply?
You got it, Press.
Yeah, it does. And, it is a standard MSF5000. So I guess what you guys are saying is that it's not necessarily a further fault inside the house. It was solved when I replaced that missing ground wire. It was a natural occurrence of the EMI filtering that might be inside that. And it was also not a coincidence that it happened on that very device. I felt this tingle before on other things. And I suppose if you think back, maybe they were always radios. Maybe they always had filters that you're talking about, Dick. Maybe it wasn't an ordinary lamp or anything else. And the 55 volts that I measured on that floating ground was because of those capacitors that are tied from hot and neutral to ground. They were passing some phantom energy and sort of doing what they were supposed to do, draining it off to ground. I just didn't have the ground there. Am I correct on that, Dick? K2RIW, W2PW in the group.
Ground that cavity for safety. Got to ground that repeater.
Yep, grounding by way of the safety wiring is the safest thing to do, as well as other kinds of backup grounding to be sure. However, right now, Howie, Glenn, Dick, we're all speculating that the EMI filter and its capacitor divider network and those 001s or whatever, 0.02s, the ceramic capacitors from each side of the line to chassis is most likely the cause. There's a way you can confirm that. You can go back to the condition where you very safely make sure that you're not putting yourself at risk. You use one of those gray plugs that eliminates the third prong You can lift the ground from the piece of equipment temporarily, if you're doing it very carefully, where you measure 57 volts from chassis to ground. Now you can start putting resistors from chassis to ground and find out how fast the voltage falls off. At a particular value of resistance, the 57 volts will go down to that half voltage, in which case now your capacitor reactants and your resistor are equal to each other. Once you do that test, it's a half voltage test, you can calculate exactly how many picofarad is doing it, or how many microfarads, and that'll tell you exactly where it's coming from. I think when you do that calculation and the test, if you decide to do it, you'll know immediately, is it just the straight capacitance of the wiring of the house? I doubt it highly. I think it's a real fixed capacitor in your EMI filter that's doing it. And as I said, there's various ways you can measure that amount of capacitance. A capacitance measuring meter with the hold-on circuit turned off. In other words, pull your main fuse of the house is the safest way to do it. Pull the main circuit breaker. And then with a capacitance measuring type of digital multimeter, measure from chassis to earth when you refloat it, and you know exactly what's going on. That would be a fun experiment to do it by pulling the main circuit breaker. That's the safest way to do it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And when you do that experiment, Chris, I'd like you to come back and tell us what you find. There was another person who said he wanted to make a comment. Please give us your call letters and your name, and then your comment, sir. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
WA1VVH.
Hey, Dick, this is John, KC2WGB in Staten Island. I just want to let you know that I'm wondering if he has VX cabling in metal boxes, or does he have Romex in plastic boxes, and if it was a three-terminal outlet that he was plugged into in his metal box of VX, he should not need a ground wire at all. So you're right. Those capacitors and that little network will bleed down to the chassis, and if it is not grounded, he will be hot. But I was wondering what type of wiring he had in his house.
WW with another safety comment, Dick.
How we recognize, John, he did tell us earlier that the third prong was floating in the wiring of his house, and he has since corrected that. That's what started it off in the first place. So whether the house is wired with three-wire Romex or BX or whatever almost doesn't matter, because he knows that the third prong was floating, and he has since corrected it. WA1VVH, I know I should know you. Start off with your name and your comment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hello, Dick. Name is Harry. I just heard you in there talking, and I just want to say hello. Conditions are sort of fluctuating tonight, so I don't know if I'm going to keep holding the repeater. Just wanted to say hello. WA1VVH, as always, your discussion is fascinating.
Yeah, I've got to recalibrate my brain. Harry is one of the guys on 10 gigahertz that I meet periodically at the, what is it called now? The Northeast Weak Signal Society. They meet up at the top of Connecticut, the bottom of Massachusetts. Why can't I think of the name of the town? And I didn't get a chance to go to the last meeting, but you can see pictures of what they did with 21 dishes all set up at this site with everyone who's doing weak signal reception. Okay, Howie, want to make a further comment? Go right ahead, Howie, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Dick, actually a comment, and I have a question that I'd like to ask you before you move on, because this would be part of this situation. First comment is this. With the MSF 5000, you want to take like a number 12 wire and ground the cabinet, because you can work at a repeater site, or with the repeater, hook up a service monitor, and you can have a voltage potential and actually damage some test equipment. So it's a good idea with all of this type of equipment, because all these repeaters, like Master Tune, any of these repeaters that are using, you know, like not a switching supply, but if they're at resonant supply or a linear supply, they're all running, you know, brute force filtering on the input. They got 001s. You know, across the line, they usually have serious chokes on the AC line, and whatever else is going on in the cabinet. So, Dick, I highly recommend to the other station that he definitely grounds that, repeater cabinet. And, Dick, I have a question that I would like to ask about a receiver, which is a Sony 2010, that has to do with this exact issue about RF on the power lines. If you could let me ask that question, it'll only take a minute.
Yeah, the horrible thing to think about is that for lots and lots of years, we all used 120-volt appliances, 115-volt appliances that had a two-prong plug to it, and a metal-cased drill motor used with a two-prong plug in 1955, we'll say, and a person decides to do sanding of the bottom of his rowboat, and he's standing in the salt water with a metal drill motor in his hand on an extension cord, and he's sanding the bottom of the boat. My goodness, is that a dangerous condition. Wow. And that went on for years and years. Ridiculous number of people died in that situation, because all you need is for some fault in the wiring of that drill motor to take place where the hot side of the 110-volt line touches that metal chassis, and now there's 120 volts between your hand and your feet that are standing in salt water, and it's game over. Or all you need is a little bit of splash of salt water to get inside of the drill motor while you're doing that operation, and even though the drill motor is pretty well insulated. Nowadays, our drill motors are plastic case. Nowadays, all of our appliances have got three prongs, and the third prong supplies this grounding to the chassis of each one of our pieces of appliance, and a hell of a lot of electrocution situations. Let me drop.
EFI.
And a lot of those electrocution situations have gone away. The ground fault indicator that we should have on all of the outside sockets of our house is a backup protection. But the primary protection is the real chassis grounding, because the GFI has a certain length of time to respond, and there can be a failure in the GFI indicator, the GFI device. And the GFI device does not work in reverse. If you've got a 110-volt generator putting away in your backyard, and you're back-feeding the outside outlet of your house, and then you're, in other words, because you've had a power failure, you're running that motor generator set in the backyard, and you're back-feeding through that GFI indicator, GFI protection device, and to back-feed the rest of the house because you've already pulled the main circuit breaker. And you got to worry about the fact that you're only feeding half the house if it's a 110-volt circuit. We won't go there. There's ways of getting around that. That GFI indicator, when being back-fed in that manner, will not give you the protection you think it will. It only works in the forward mode. So as I see it, the GFI is the backup. It's the belt and suspenders. The real protection is the third prong of the grounding and all other grounding that you should have on your ham radio equipment. Every one of us should have an EMI standard grounding rod, which is a 5/8 diameter, 8-foot long thing sunk in the ground with a connector below grade, and a piece of 6-gauge wire coming in to ground all of your pieces of equipment. You're doing that grounding for human protection purposes first, lightning protection second, possibly some EMI elimination third. Now, that one's a long shot. But the human protection and grounding of anything with a metal chassis or anything where you can come in contact with a grounded piece of metal like the SO239 PL259 connector on your piece of coax cable. You touch that piece of...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now picture the situation of a guy standing on a metal tower, and the tower itself is well grounded, and he's disconnecting or connecting a piece of coaxial cable at the top of the tower. And the other end of that cable down in the shack is connected to a piece of electronics that has a missing third wire ground on that piece of electronics. Do you see the risk that that person is at? Okay, anyone have any further questions or comments on this? I think, Howie, you want to make another comment? KQIW in the TechNet.
Dick, it's a question. I hope you don't consider it off of this subject. Sony made a radio called the Sony 2010, and you had to only use their power adapter. If you used any other power adapter, you would hear a 120-cycle hum. It wasn't an AC hum, but it was the RF being turned on and off through the cycles. I never got a schematic, but I think you can get rid of that by putting bypass caps across the diodes. Actually, from what I understand, is that if you didn't use their adapter, you would be making the house wiring and everything as part of the system, and you would, as the dials would conduct, you would hear a hum, like a modulated hum. It wasn't actual AC hum. Can you make a comment on that, Dick?
Yeah, the wall-worn power supplies that are used on many appliances, in some cases is nothing but a simple step-down transformer giving you, let me pick a number, 12 volts AC. And then the real rectification and filtering takes place in the appliance itself. That's the way some of the wall warts are made. Some of the wall warts are a complete power supply. Step-down transformer, rectifier, filter network, and out comes pure regulated plus 12 volts, for instance. Some of the wall warts are like that. So if Sony had set it up in such a way that their particular power supply supplied fully regulated plus 12 volts to the appliance, your 2010 radio, and if your particular wall wart is the kind that only supplied rectified but not filtered, or pure AC, then you could get the condition you're talking about. I wonder if you had a chance of under loaded conditions, put an oscilloscope on the voltage going into the appliance. It would have been interesting to see what's happening with the Sony wall wart versus the one that you tried using. I'm guessing that the pulsations that you were hearing were improper regulation of the raw voltage going into that radio. Over to you, Howie, K2LIW on the TechNet.
KEY with a comment on it.
Yeah, Mel, Dick, you're not listening. No, because if you lose a pure DC power supply, a pure regulated DC power supply, you would still get that. And you would only hear that hum when a station came in with a carrier, even if there was noise. This was a shortwave radio. But what I could assume and understand, if you looked at the schematic, the signal coming in would be turned on and off by 120 seconds based on the conduction of diodes. That through the diodes of the power supply, the Sony had a regulator supply with a rectifier. And I used other supplies, and from what I understand and can see, that the AC signal coming in, you know, the RF signal riding in on the AC signal, would be turned on and off at 120 times a second, Dick.
KC2, QIQ with a comment.
Interesting. Glenn recognized, but Mel first. I wonder if you ran into this one, Mel, and if you understand it. K2KEY in the group, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Exactly. Know the 2010 quite well. The power supply for the 2010 is 3 volts. The wall wart that they give you for it is complete. Comes out of the 3 volt DC. The outer shield of the wall wart, there's a piece of shielded cable that comes from the wall wart a certain length. And the shield is positive, and the center conductor is the negative. That's the way they set it up, Dick. A little hocus pocus there, but I won't go any further right now, but that's basically how they are power supplied for the 2010 works, over.
And was that power lead possibly being used as part of the antenna on some frequencies where the radio worked? Mel, go ahead.
Suspect that, because it was a piece of shielded wire, and it is, you know, I looked at it and I said, gee, kind of long for you know, them being that generous. You know, usually they don't give you that much wire. This thing has got about 8 foot of wire or something like that, 6 to 8 foot of wire, and I couldn't figure out and say, what the heck have they got in mind here? But looking a little closer, I see this means to their madness, over.
Glenn, have you analyzed that 2010, and what did you find out? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I've never had a 2010, but here's the thing. I am pretty sure I understand what the problem is here. But I have a question for Howie first. Howie, have you ever tried running this on a battery?
It has built-in batteries. It has D batteries inside, yes. But I could tell that it wasn't 120 cycles. It sounded like it was turning on and off the signal. It was actually modulating the signal. And I think he's right. It had a shielded cable. This was many years ago. I'm just bringing this up because I've heard about this problem other places, and I've read that in some applications they have to put dials and be very fancy in the network to make sure that the dials don't conduct and turn on and off, to make sure that you're not making the signal weaker or stronger. Because if you modulate the signal, you can hear that hum. Go ahead, Dick.
Are you ready for the answer?
K2 give us?
Go ahead, I'm ready for the answer.
Got it, Glenn.
Okay, Howie, what's really causing the noise? I mean, I've seen this in VoIP phones, over the Ethernet. I've seen this problem in many, many areas, especially when using wall adapters. And it's not really anything to do with the regulation voltage. What really is happening is you're getting common mode interference that's running back down through the power adapter into the wall. And the only way to break that up is you can use a common mode inductor, but you're going to need a lot of inductance. And what they've probably done inside the Sony adapters, they probably built up the common mode filtering as part of the regulator itself. So in other words, they probably floated both the plus and the minus side and then used a coaxial cable to balance out the common mode filtering. And this way it bypassed the noise or notched it out. That's one method. Another way is just sometimes a big isolation transformer on the input will do it, or a really nice common mode filter. And that'll usually kill all the noise, because I'm quite sure that that is a common mode problem. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the way these radios on HF frequencies, how they receive their signals sometimes from the plastic package of the radio to what it's using as an antenna can be a little bit mysterious. When it comes to portable radios, Lou, NY2H, wanted us to make sure that everyone recognizes the fact that the Sunday issue of Newsday newspaper on page Echo 5 has a nice article about the invention of a car radio, and Motorola is giving credit for that. Motorola also, by way of Martin Cooper.
This week? This Sunday?
Today's issue of Newsday, page Echo 5, the Sunday issue of Newsday on 2010, what is this, July 18th, has that article. Also, for years we've all heard about Martin Cooper, who made the very first cell phone call on April 1973 in New York City. And Martin Cooper of, again, Motorola, is given credit for inventing the cell phone. Well, yes, he did do the first operation of a real cell site into a real portable cell phone. That was the first operation. Let me drop. But my ham radio microwave friend, Reed Fisher, W2CQH, Whiskey 2, Charlie, Quebec Hotel, gave me a very nice long discussion about cell phone radios in the winter of 1971, more than 2 years earlier. He was describing the cell phone concept to me. He had already made trips to Japan because they were in discussions with the Japanese manufacturers of the actual hardware in order to bring the price of the cell phones and the equipment being used at cell sites down. And so I've had a number of email discussions with Reed Fisher and the so-called Martin Cooper situation. Like many ideas that had multiple fathers of the actual idea, who should really be given credit? It's not so easy. As you know,
you know who invented the walkie-talkie?
Who invented the walkie-talkie?
To get it for you a minute, it was a guy who also invented CB, and he also invented the cordless phone and the pager. He died in 2002. You have to Google it. Google walkie-talkie, and it'll come up with him. He also made a walkie-talkie on 300 megahertz.
It turns out that the invention of laser was heavily contested for a long period of time, and whether or not the man at the IBM got credit for it is something to worry about. Lots and lots of things have had multiple fathers, but cell phone is certainly a very ubiquitous piece of electronics these days. If you see the latest issue of Antennas and Propagation magazine from the IEEE, there's a beautiful article in there about both cell phone radiation and a preceding article about how addicted some cell phone people, users are. Let me drop. There are situations that I've seen on some of the news programs where a person is at the altar saying his wedding vows on his wedding day, and the man is text messaging his friends telling him what he is doing at that time. Wow. and there are various organizations that will count up the number of hours per week that teenage students are using text messaging and Facebook and all these other connective techniques. I mean, we amateur radio operators have been using handy talkies for a long time. And when it comes to action at a distance and a radio in your hand and portability, we sort of take it for granted. There's a hell of a lot of people out there, the first time they get a portable radio device in their hand, they're so enthralled with it that it becomes very obsessive and addicted behavior. And the total number of hours that they use it per hour, per day, per week, and the total number of hours they're spending is really something else. Bernie, you want to make a comment on this? KQRIW on the TechNet.
Dick, sorry for the interruption, but there's no other way to break in. I need about 90 seconds for a housekeeping issue, so if we could get that done before the midnight hour, please, KQYO.
And I had this question, if you can answer.
There was a person before Wesley just signed in right now who wanted to make a comment. Who was that?
KEY.
Go ahead, Mel.
They asked about when the walkie-talkie came into existence. During World War II, I guess you may have seen it, a number of the pictures, war pictures and all, that they had that field walkie-talkie called the BC, I think it was the 227 or 231 series, made by Bendix, which was a true walkie-talkie, and it was also self-contained, and pulled the antenna out. I got one, in fact. You pull the antenna out, it turns it on. Contains, I think, the 6-tube, and had no volume controls or anything like that, fixed on 3.885. That's why after World War II, there was a lot of 3.885 80-meter crystals around, because they were made for those walkie-talkies. And it ran on two 67.5-volt C batteries and two two D cells, Dick. And it's in a heavy case, you know, quite a hefty thing, but it was a true walkie-talkie, of all places, on 80 meters with about 42-inch width over.
Mel, does that thing also have what looks like a telephone handpiece against the side of the cabinet, so you held this thing up against your ear and you talked into something that looked like a telephone mouthpiece? Back to you, Mel.
So he came into use 1942. I'm looking at the picture of it now, in fact. It was a square box, completely square, had a hand strap. You stuck your hand through the hand strap, like if they pulled the antenna out, that turned it on, and your hand going through the strap to the other side of the case from you. In other words, your hand holding it up against your ear and talking into it, had the button, the push-to-talk button, that's all. It only had no, you didn't set no volume, you couldn't do anything. 3.885, stick over.
And that was World War II. We've come a long way since then. Okay, Wesley, you wanted to make a question or a comment. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. I had a question how to make a spectrum analyzer acting as a network analyzer, back to you.
That's a pretty tough one, Wesley. A vector network analyzer, as we discussed earlier, is really a synthesized signal generator that usually steps through a number of frequencies, although you could make it fixed if you wanted to. It uses that synthesizer signal generator signal to excite the circuit that you're measuring. The response of the circuit that you're measuring is then put into a receiver-like device that measures not only amplitude but phase. There is a simplified version of a scalar network analyzer which only measures the magnitude of the reflection coefficient or the magnitude of the signal going through, and it ignores phase. That one can only give you an XY display. It cannot give you a polar-like display. It can't give you a Smith chart. So a small number of the network analyzers are scalar. The vast majority are vector. They really measure amplitude and phase. Since essentially no spectrum analyzer measures phase, that represents a bit of a problem. Now, for a really crafty person like yourself, you could, with some difficulty, add an extra circuit to your spectrum analyzer so that it measures not only amplitude but measures phase. But calibrating it, the actual calibration procedure, let me drop this. The actual calibration procedure that a vector network analyzer goes through is quite elaborate. It's called the 12-step program or the 12-step calculation. In order for it to reference itself at the end of your test cable, because very rarely can you and I connect the circuit under test right to the front panel, particularly if it's a great big antenna or something like that. Usually you're testing something at the end of a test cable, and you go through a calibration procedure in which you force the vector network analyzer to act like all of its instrumentation is connected at the last thousandth of an inch of the test cable. That's what it acts like. And therefore you find out what's going on there right at the point of contact to your circuit under test. To come up with that calibration procedure and to come up with the phase measuring network into a spectrum analyzer would be very difficult. Not impossible, but that would keep you busy for an awful long period of time. So is it doable? Yes. Is it worth it? I'm a bit skeptical, as you can tell. There have been a couple of articles in QEX magazine, among other places, about how to homebrew a amateur radio qualified vector network analyzer, the so-called antenna analyzer. Some of these antenna analyzers that we can buy really are a network analyzer, though they don't have quite the accuracy, they don't have quite the calibration capability, they don't have quite as much display, dynamic range, and so on. But 30 or so years ago, measuring phase at an RF frequency was considered something very exotic. Nowadays, measuring phase up to 100 gigahertz is considered almost simple.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
With the right piece of instrumentation. So maybe that helps a little bit as to what you're asking, Wesley, if I understood the question. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I believe I have a solution for that. It's not that difficult unless you correct me that I'm wrong. But a tracking generator is actually part of the network analyzer. So I have discovered in my 3585A, which is a purely spectrum analyzer, that it does have a strange looking PLC connector, and the regulation for the voltage. And then I was looking at the manual, and I find out that it says clearly that this generator is made for this device to serve as a network analyzer. So if you couple output of the tracking generator to input of spectrum analyzer, and I'll be getting the network analyzer, and I'm just testing my coils with it. And I would like to hear something about that formula, so this way I could find out how can I use it. I don't have a switch rod, definitely, and the polar one does not exist, but I have a voltage versus frequency vector.
Dick? Yeah, I'm listening to Wesley on the input, because on the input he sounds clean, but through the repeater there's a lot of distortion. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, $600 to Pentek gets you that project that you saw in QEX, and it has actually progressed since the QEX article.
Yeah, a tracking generator added to a spectrum analyzer makes it a very handy instrument. To be a scalar network analyzer with that combination is rather easy, and it can be made very accurate. I'm still a little worried, though, about the fact that the 3585, I think it is, yeah, 3585, is that a, no, I don't think that has digital signal processing. I think that goes up to something like some number of megacycles, like a significant number of megacycles, that particular spectrum analyzer, and because it doesn't have digital signal processing, to give it phase measuring characteristic, to give full vector network analyzer, I think would be difficult. To be a scalar network analyzer, I think is easy. Did the instruction manual on your 3585 spectrum analyzer with tracking generator, did it say it could be a scalar or vector network analyzer, or did it just say network analyzer? Back to you, Wesley. N2XJN, K2LIW.
You're 2TTT with an add-on query into that.
Gordon recognized, but Wesley first, go ahead.
Yeah, well, what it says is in the manual, I'm trying to get to this page, it's a vector network analyzer, I believe, and I was so stunned when I read that, and I connect the way that they told me to connect in the manual, and I've got it. I've got a horizontal line with the deep on it in the frequency when the cutoff of the frequency for a low pass filter. You described it properly. Can you correct me in this one?
Yeah, it sounds like you're describing an XY display, and a scalar network analyzer can only give you an XY display. It can't give you a polar display. Therefore, it can't give you a Smith chart. That's not bad, but it's just one of the capabilities that is very valuable in a vector network analyzer as you get deeper into circuit analysis. You'd like to have a Smith chart display, if possible. Gordon, W2TTT, go right ahead. K2LAW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. We were over at the Passaic County Fair all last 5 days working that, and I just got home and had to go out to do an errand. And I think you partially answered my question. But I think it might be instructive for a broader audience to just summarize what the benefits of a vector network analyzer are over a scalar and what the fundamental differences are. That might be useful, because my guess is there are a lot of people going, huh, scalar, vector, scalar. What does that mean?
Yeah, at about 8:15 tonight, I did go into a fairly long tirade in which I was trying to describe the advantage of vector over scalar. But just to give it two or three sentences again right now, a scalar network analyzer measures the amplitude response of a circuit under test. It's a signal generator plus the equivalent of a kind of a spectrum analyzer, and so it gives you an XY plot of response versus frequency, and that response could be signal going through or signal being reflected because of a standing wave ratio situation. But to go the next step, to measure the phase of the response of the circuit of the test, gives the ability to make a polar diagram of the display, and therefore, in the case of measuring standing wave ratio, the polar diagram of reflected signal, when you're measuring standing wave ratio of a device on the test, that is a Smith chart. And to a smart person who knows how to properly interpret a Smith chart, particularly with marker frequencies on that display, it gives you a tremendous amount of information that allows you to, let me drop, it allows an informed person, a person with experience, he can recognize immediately the squiggles that he gets on that Smith chart versus swept frequency. He knows immediately, is that a band pass filter? Is that a band reject filter? Does that filter have two poles, three poles? Is that an antenna? Is that a transmission line? Is it an amplifier fed forward? Is it an amplifier fed backwards? Is the amplifier breaking into oscillation? Does the amplifier have suck out frequencies? Does the amplifier have undesired group delay distortion? There's a zillion things you can get out of that Smith chart display if you are a person with enough experience. Tremendous amount. I could almost say it's got four times more information. I will admit that the scalar display, the XY display, is the first piece of response you want to know. It'll tell you the magnitude of reflected signal, which tells you the magnitude of standing wave ratio, but it doesn't tell you if the device is acting in a capacitive manner, a resistive manner, a high impedance manner, or a low impedance manner. A Smith chart tells you those details. A scalar network analyzer says, this is the VISWAR, but I'm not going to tell you what's causing it. And so, as you can see, there's a lot more information if you're willing to go the extra mile in a vector manner. Now, Bernie wants to do some kind of vital calibration that's got to be done before the bewitching hour. So, Bernie, why don't you do that right now? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW on the TechNet.
I'm sorry, Dick, I may have misled you. Not a calibration, but I just wanted to ask you if you could say hello to our friends around the globe. They've been off for a couple of weeks, but so far tonight, the countries that have been listening to TechNet are England, Trinidad and Tobago, Japan, Australia, Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Taiwan. States within our own country are Pennsylvania, Maryland, Kentucky, our buddies out in Nevada, Washington State, and Virginia. So the TechNet is back global again this week. So if you could just give them a brief hello and hey, and we appreciate them being out there. Thank you.
Okay. What you guys are listening to is called the Technical Net. It's run in the one of the main repeaters in the New York City area. The moderators of this Technical Net are Mel, K2 Kilo, Echo Yankee, and Dick, K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. This Technical Net began in September of 1982, 27 and a half years ago. It has met almost every single Sunday night, local time, 8 o'clock, ever since then for 27 and a half years. In the beginning, it was a one-hour net from 8 o'clock till 9 o'clock. And we soon realized that this particular repeater, covers the tri-state area around New York City in the United States. Northern New Jersey, the state of New Jersey, southern New York State, and southwestern Connecticut. In that area, we believe there are typically hundreds of people listening to the 146 megacycle output of this repeater, 146.85 megacycles, and lots of people listening. And what Mel and Dick do is they gather the clan on Sunday night, and we discuss our favorite subject, wireless radio in particular, but all kinds of electronic subjects. And we share that information. We teach each other something about the 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. We teach each other antennas and feed lines and circuits and transmitters and receivers and propagation and whatever. And for a person who wants to listen to past Technical Nets, let me drop. There's a website you can do that. A very enthusiastic man named Mike Perry, Kilo Charlie 2, November Juliet India, has created a website which you can find at www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that website and you find the so-called Technical Net, and you can find 1 hour at a time reels that you can download and listen to past Technical Nets. And Mike has also assembled some of the information that is on specific subjects. Occasionally, Mel will have a canned program on Smith chart or decibels or things like that, and you can go to those, you can go directly to those particular discussions, so to speak. The vast majority of the Technical Nets, the subject of discussion is not planned on ahead of time. The people show up, they got a particular question in mind, and we discuss that particular question. Mel and Dick have been around electronics for numbers like 50 years. We've had quite a bit of exposure, and therefore we add our 2 cents worth, and a whole lot of other people help us out and correct our errors when we make them. So that's where the information is coming from, and we occasionally make errors, and as I said, we try to correct those. So it seems to have worked out rather well over those years. It's increasing. We're up to now 4 hours of actual running time every Sunday night from 8 o'clock local until midnight. And that's a thumbnail sketch about the Technical Net. Back to you, Bernie, for any other comments. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW in the TechNet.
Nope, that's it, Dick. Just wanted you to say hello to our friends around the world and let them know we do appreciate them. Many of them cannot, due to the delays, the linking and everything, get in directly. But we want to let them know that we appreciate them being out there, and we hope they're having as much fun with that net as we are. K2YO.
As the listeners can probably tell, the group that gathers gets so enthusiastic. It's a little bit like some of these news programs on our local television where you see so-called enthusiastic and sometimes expert people coming together and all shouting on top of each other. And so just the group that we've got gathered in the New York City area They all want to say their comments and ask their questions, and therefore that combined with the amount of delay that's required for proper operation of EchoLink and IRLP and the other kinds of internet connections, I know it makes it very difficult for a person in the out areas to sign in and to get their edge in word-wise, so to speak. We know that that's frustrating, and for the time being, we don't know of an exact solution to that. Eric, KE2EJ, our broadcast engineering expert, is working on ways of making an improvement, and quite possibly sometime in the future, the people in the outlying areas will be able to sign in. The timing will become more amenable to that. Okay, what you guys have just listened to is TechNet number 1306 of the series that began in September of 1982, way back in the dark ages. On the assumption that Mel and I stay healthy and the rest of the guys stay enthusiastic, we'll be back next Sunday and try to do a little more of this. And we'll dig more into these electrons and find out what they're really doing. Mel, go right ahead and back with your any other comments. K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. K2RIW.
CB to HWW.
How we recognize, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, you know, we're just about ready to shut down. This is K2KEY. All righty. I hope that everybody is satisfied tonight, that we did pick up all the questions. I'm sure I checked very carefully my list here. And that please... Please take it easy with the emails and all. We'll try our best to continue this way and make the TechNet interesting, but also we will also promise, if possible, to cover everybody's question and not skip anybody, whether they are local or coming in through one of the other modes. 73's all. Have a great week. Try to stay cool and we all can get together next week. This is K2KEY, saying 73 minutes. Good evening.
Dick, would you have a little time to, after the net, to ask one question is important to me?
Yeah, hold on a little bit, Wesley. Did I hear somebody say the word London? If so, try that again. Maybe not. Go ahead, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Stick 73, and the guy, I would think it was Alfred Gross. He invented the walkie-talkie. Do you know Alfred Gross, Dick?
I've heard that name. Over to you, Wesley.
It is important to me because I'm standing in front of spending $6,500, and I just want to make sure that I'm doing the right thing. There is another device. It is being called 4194A, impedance gain phase analyzer. And what I'm trying to achieve actually is make sure that the coil that I'm doing is tuned to the particular frequency. And at the point, that is 20 kilohertz. And get the most of the information about it. So I have right now, as far as the spectrum analyzers, I have the one that goes to 40 gigahertz from zero almost, and the other one that is going to me on its way probably tomorrow after tomorrow, it's 8 gigahertz. This one, the old one, has the tracking generators. I have a primitive network analyzer, and then the HP419. Could you just say about this device?
Okay.
I was listening to you on the input because through the repeater the signal is quite distorted. The 4194A impedance phase gain analyzer. Sorry to say, I'm not familiar with that. Can't make any pronouncements on that one. And would that serve as a vector network analyzer? Interesting question. I will look that one up, either 4194 or 4494. I've heard you say both numbers. I'll look that up and see if I can come to a conclusion. And is that going to help you analyze the primary and secondary winding of a Tesla coil, is what I think you're analyzing right now, one of your first experiments.